Is Lockhart versus Chandler, Mr. Dierkop.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Eric Dierkop, counsel for Petitioner James Lockhart. This case is an appeal of the dismissal of Mr. Lockhart's habeas petition. The issues to be decided are taken from the Court's March 22, 2005 order granting Mr. Lockhart a certificate of appealability. The issues drawn from that order are, one, whether ground 9 of Mr. Lockhart's petition, which asserts that his due process rights were violated by a biased trial judge, was fairly presented to the Illinois Supreme Court. And two, whether ground 7 of his petition, which asserts that his trial judge improperly stated before the jury that race was not an issue in his case when that was his defense, can be dismissed as an independent and adequate state ground. I'll start with ground 9. In dismissing ground 9, Judge Bucklow concluded that this due process claim had not been presented to Illinois Supreme Court. Judge Bucklow therefore held that the claim had been waived. Under this Court's decisions considering procedural defaults, in particular fair presentment defaults, a habeas petitioner may pursue a federal claim so long as he first fairly presents the claim to the state appellate court. Now, this is a practical test, as explained by this Court's decision in Sanders. A petitioner fairly presents a claim if he affords the state court a meaningful opportunity to pass on it. The question, then, is whether Mr. Lockhart afforded the Illinois Supreme Court a meaningful opportunity to consider his claim. And the answer is yes. Although I'll acknowledge that Mr. Lockhart, acting pro se, was perhaps inartful in the drafting of his petition for leave to file or leave to appeal, enough was in it or incorporated into it to provide the Illinois Supreme Court with a meaningful opportunity to evaluate his claim of a biased trial judge. Turning to the PLA, Mr. Lockhart presented his judicial bias claim most clearly as Argument C of his PLA. There, he alleged that the Illinois Appellate Court had failed to address certain enumerated arguments that he laid up below, as well as certain other arguments. In the body of that discussion, Argument C, Mr. Lockhart referred the Illinois Supreme Court to what he had described or entitled a Motion for Equal Protection Analysis Comprehensive Appeal, which he had filed before the state appellate court. And this, according to his brief, was stated in his brief, was attached to the PLA. So in turn, looking at the Motion for Equal Protection Analysis, point 13 of that motion expressly argued to the Illinois Appellate Court, which is where it was filed, that court had previously...
How many points were there?
I believe there were 13.
This was the last?
Actually, I have it right here. I can tell you for sure. It may or may not have been the last. If you just give me a moment. I'm going to stand corrected. There were 20 points.
Well, does a state court have to find a needle in a haystack?
Well, the answer, I believe, is going to be no, but I don't believe that this qualifies as a needle in a haystack.
Well, how long is this incorporated motion?
Well, let's take a look. It's pages 219 through 229 of the... Well, that includes the certificate of service, or the notice of filing, actually. It looks to be 10 pages.
Mm-hmm. How long was his brief?
His brief was the original brief that he presented to the Illinois Appellate Court. Is that the one you're referring to, Your Honor?
Well, what was the brief to which this motion was appended?
The petition for leave to appeal, I don't believe I have a full copy of it up here, but it was not sizable.
That was the document to which this was incorporated?
It was specifically incorporated by reference. That's right, Your Honor. But it wasn't what I would characterize as a voluminous document.
Small haystack.
Issue number in point 13, as I was saying, of that motion for equal protection, Mr. Lockhart expressly argued that the Illinois Appellate Court had previously ignored the totality of the record of issue number 10 within his opening appeal brief. And in fact, this had been the problem.
Well, wait, so is that a third and another incorporation?
It is, because he refers, well, his argument is...
So to understand that what he's complaining about, you would have to go to that, you would have to go to that point 10 or something?
The Illinois Supreme Court would have had to have considered. His argument was that...
Does the Supreme Court of Illinois allow incorporation by reference in applications for leave to appeal?
I don't know that offhand.
That's a vital proposition, is it not? I mean, we don't. The Supreme Court of the United States doesn't. I would be shocked if the Supreme Court of Illinois does.
I'm not aware of any requirement or prohibition in the Illinois Supreme Court's rules. I believe it's Rule 315. I'll have to review my notes, but I'm certainly not aware of any prohibition of exhibits for
corporations. What you describe is these papers. I don't know that the court can be criticized for not having realized what he was arguing.
Well, there's nothing in the record to...
What does that point 10 say that he incorporated at the second level by reference?
Issue number 10 was his claim that the trial judge, which is Judge Sachs, had been biased against him in trial. The very title of that section was that he'd been denied a fair and impartial trial by jury because of a biased judge. In issue number 10, he recited numerous instances in which Judge Sachs had made comments.
But the issue of bias is different from an issue of improper rulings. So you're concerned about this, with his saying race was not an issue. Now, that could be evidence of bias, or it could be an independent error. So does he make clear that he's complaining about that statement as having poisoned the jury, as distinct from having indicated bias on the part of Judge Sachs?
He makes both claims in issue number 10. On page 15,
issue 10?
Yes. On page 59 of his brief, he expressly quotes the language of that the race
That's
is not
fine,
an issue.
But now what does he say is the problem, that it poisoned the jury or that it showed that Judge Sachs was biased?
He makes both claims in
what
issue number
10. What does
he say? I can quote for you. I mean, as close as I can, I believe in pages 57 and 58, he quotes statements.
This is his brief before the Illinois Appellate Court.
He quotes statements by Judge Sachs to the extent that...
Yes, I know he quotes them. And then what does he do?
I believe he refers to them deprived him of an impartial tribunal.
Yes, but don't you realize that's different? It's different from saying the judge was biased and the jury was poisoned, right?
I understand
that.
Those
are two separate things. So what did he say about the jury, about the effect on the jury of this statement by the judge? If you remember, if you don't remember.
In page 59, he lays out a number of claims about Judge Sachs's involvement with the jury.
I know you've said that. All right, we're not
and then he cites
that.
Cases to the fact that he's invaded the province of the jury, that he's improperly influenced the jury, and he cites two cases for that.
Okay.
One of which deals in the parenthetical with that notion. Also, in issue number 10, Mr. Lockhart cited the cases, which were, although they were state cases, stood for the proposition that the absence of an impartial judge is sufficient to deprive a party of a fair trial. And we identify and discuss those cases in our reply brief. So, in his...
You'll see that you have a good case that Judge Sachs was biased. He was exasperated. He was driven crazy. He wanted to scream and bite his lip and so on. But that's different from being biased, isn't it?
It can be.
Judges can get quite irritated with people. That doesn't mean it affects their judgment. It just affects their blood pressure.
Well, it can reflect a bias, and that the comments crossed the line, that they were sufficiently bitter as to indicate a
bias as opposed to exasperation. You know, these defendants who insist on defending themselves very mistakenly, they do drive the judges crazy.
I'm out of time, but I will, of course, answer your question. Is that there are at least two comments. First of all, there's this comment before the jury that race wasn't an issue, where he was indicating his view or closed-mindedness as to the viability of the defendant's theory of the case.
He didn't say race is not an issue. I mean, that's a distinct problem. What he said is that the particular question, do you like black men doing X to white women? The judge said that is not an issue. He then allowed a charge to the jury on a race bias defense.
Beyond that, he referred at the third trial, at the beginning of the trial, in another moment of exasperation, he referred to the defendant's efforts in the case in defending himself as milking the system. And we refer you to a Ninth Circuit opinion which characterizes that sort of statement as one suggesting that
and why? You know, the state has cited the Lytecky decision here, which is where the Supreme Court held that judicial exasperation is not a form of bias. I was struck by the fact that neither your opening brief nor your reply brief mentions Lytecky.
Lytecky.
Do you have anything to say about Lytecky now?
Lytecky does not have an absolute... It does say that sort of anger or intemperance by a judge isn't grounds for finding that the judge is biased. But it does leave open... It does say that a judge can cross the line if it becomes too far. I can refer you to... Lytecky says that there's an exception, that bias could become so extreme
you can imagine
or it can
that.
Be a rare
now,
case.
If you compare what the judge said here with what the Supreme Court held in Lytecky was not evidence of bias, which judge was more exasperated or irate in court, do you think? This judge or the judge in Lytecky?
I'd say this judge seemed pretty irate, but in Lytecky, the Supreme Court referred to a German espionage case, where it said where the judge it was an older case and it pointed to it as an example.
Yes, the judge in that case suggested that there was no way a German was ever going to have a fair trial in his court, but there's certainly nothing in these proceedings which suggested there's no way a black man is ever going to have a fair trial in his court.
I don't think
this judge went through this multiple times and allowed the jury to be instructed on this man's theory of defense.
I don't think that he didn't need to say that a black man won't get a fair trial in my courtroom. All he has to say is in the Franklin case, focus on one individual and indicate that individual won't get a fair trial in his courtroom. That was sufficient in that case, and there was nothing to suggest that the judge there had a broader animus towards indigent defendants.
I must say, this line of argument just collapses the difference between trial error and bias. On this line of argument, every trial error requires the disqualification of the judge for bias, and I don't understand what would be gained by doing that.
I don't understand why this leads to some slippery slope that means every trial error, the fact that a judge makes a mistake doesn't suggest that the judge is biased. But here the judge has made vituperous comments regarding the petitioner and also has been critical of the defendant's efforts, referring to him as milking the system. You know, that goes beyond mere mistakes.
That's one of the big problems you have is that most of these comments all occurred outside the presence of the jury. you know, you'd have a much stronger, perhaps a stronger case if these comments that he was making were in front of the jury. But those were all, most every comment was outside the presence of the jury, right?
Well, certainly not the one where...
Yeah, I know, there's the one, right. But all the other statements, and you're relying on those other statements to try to make your bias argument as well, right? Because you
certainly
must
you
look
are.
At the totality.
Yes.
I'm just saying you've only got that one statement in front of the jury and the fact that he could argue his theory before the jury and the fact that he got the instructions. I mean, I think that's a big problem for you, that so much of this dialogue was outside the presence of the jury and the judge was careful in terms of when those comments were made.
I understand your point, Your Honor, and I appreciate that I am out of time, but I'm happy to answer this question. Is that I don't think the fact that the comments were made either before or outside the presence of the jury is dispositive on a bias claim, and I return again to the Franklin case. There, the judge's comments were in a memo that was submitted to the state Supreme Court, and of course, there's no indication that any bias he may have had was trotted out in front of the jury. So the question ultimately becomes, was he biased or not? And whether or not that was that bias was displayed to the jury is not dispositive.
We have cases in which we sanction a lawyer and we're very critical. We're not accused of bias because we've sanctioned a lawyer and been very critical of a lawyer.
It will be now.
And his objections to Lockhart are to Lockhart in Lockhart's capacity as a self-representing, you know, lawyer. Now he doesn't say, you know, Lockhart, you're guilty, you're wasting your time, I don't want to have a trial, you know, just lock him up. That would be bias. But just saying, you know, you're representing yourself, you have a fool for a client, you're driving me nuts, you don't know how the system works. That's not bias.
Well, he does refer to him as milking the system. He does claim...
Yeah, milking the system, it may be a very accurate description. We say that about lawyers, you know.
Yeah,
trying to
let me repeat it. It looked to me like he was trying to milk the system. You can now file your motion for recusal.
He also asserted that, you know, there are other criticisms of Mr. Lockhart's character, and I, before you jump on me for that, you know, he for example, criticized or essentially asserted that Mr. Lockhart had no ethics and made other comments about his character.
Yeah, but he's talking about his conduct as a lawyer, not his conduct as a person accused of rape.
There's
okay, well, thank you. We've gone way over, Mr. Dierkopf. Not your fault, but nevertheless, we have to move on. Ms. Griffin?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Colleen Griffin from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. The petitioner was convicted in 1998.
Okay, well, just respond to Mr. Dear cop, you don't have to go back to the beginning of the...
The district court found that petitioner's habeas claim 9 was procedurally defaulted.
Yeah, we know that.
By the fact that it was not included.
Get to the point, right? Don't just repeat what we know.
That it was not raised in his petition for leave to appeal.
Yes, we know that. We know that.
And petitioner believes that it was raised in his petition for leave to appeal.
We know that. We just heard him telling us that.
The reference in the petition for leave to appeal to the motion for analytical...
What about Judge Easterbrook's question? Does the Illinois Supreme Court or the other Illinois courts, do they permit a person to preserve an issue by incorporating by reference some previous filing?
I'm not aware that they do or do not allow that. I believe, though, that the motion that the petitioner referred to was attached to the petition for leave to appeal, but I don't know if that would make any difference. In any event...
I mean, do they have page limitations or word limitations on briefs?
I believe there are page limitations.
I mean, doesn't that implicitly exclude incorporation by reference? I mean, otherwise you could say, well, you know, here's my 50-page brief, and by the way, I've incorporated by reference another 1,000 pages of argument, which I've
incorporated Larry Tribe's constitutional law treatise and make all the arguments therein.
Yes, I believe that they would want an issue to be presented in the
you
text
believe that,
of the
but you
petition.
You didn't do any research to find out.
No, I did not.
I'm kind of shocked.
However,
that neither side tried to answer this question, given that whether this was preserved depends on the propriety of incorporation by reference. Maybe I've just revealed more bias. I'll have to recuse myself again.
Well, in any event, the actual claim raised in the petition for leave to appeal was that the appellate court had not decided some of the issues that petitioner presented before it, and he claimed that that was a constitutional violation of his constitutional right to access to the courts. Then he refers to this motion that he had filed in the appellate court, and even in that motion, the issue presented in the motion was that the appellate court had denied him access to the court because it did not address this claim of, and then it was the judicial statement regarding judicial bias. And at some point, a reference to it included in a totally separate issue just becomes too attenuated. The Illinois Supreme Court simply was not required to muddle through all these separate documents that were referred to and come up with this issue before it, and that is exactly what fair presentment is. The issue must be fairly presented to the state court so that they can identify it and address the federal constitutional claim before it, and this simply did not occur in this case. Therefore, the district court correctly held that petitioner's claim 9 had not been presented in a petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. There's an additional basis that this court can find that the claim 9 was procedurally defaulted, and that was in effect what the district court had found was the reason that petitioner's claim 7 was procedurally defaulted, that there was an independent and adequate state court ground. The respondent in the district court had contended that claim 9 was decided by the appellate court and found to be waived by that court. The district court disagreed and found that it was the claim 7 that had been decided, waived by the appellate court, but we assert in our brief that it was, in fact, the habeas state claim 9, that claim 7 was never even presented to the state appellate court as a separate ground for relief. This court also had issued the certificate of appealability on that independent and adequate state ground finding, and I'd like to briefly address that. The petitioner claims that independent and adequate state ground was not a sufficient finding for procedural default because that in Illinois, Illinois has a rule that conduct based or claims based on a judge's conduct need not be objected to in order to preserve the claim for appeal. However, the cases that the petitioner cites to merely state that an appellate court may review a claim if it's based on a trial judge's conduct in its discretion. There's also cases that find that a failure to object to a judge's conduct forfeits the issue. So at best in Illinois, there is inconsistent treatment in the application of the waiver rule when the underlying conduct is based on judge's actions. And in Miranda versus Liebach, this court found that inconsistencies in application will not render the rule inadequate for purposes of the procedural default inquiry. Respondent believes that's an additional reason this court can find procedural default. And briefly on the merits regarding the bias claim, the statements made by the judge in this case are exactly what the United States Supreme Court found insufficient to establish bias in Latecky. Yes, there were times when Judge Sachs may have expressed impatience and annoyance. However, none of those statements made by him rise to the level of what the petitioner would need to show in this case, and that would be actual bias on the part of the judge. The cases that petitioner cites in his opening brief for structural error are where there is a personal direct or pecuniary type interest on the part of the judge that shows an actual bias or partiality on the part of the judge. And in those type of situations, once that's shown, there can be no harmless error review. And that type of showing was simply not in this case. And in Franklin versus McCautry, where there was a prejudgment shown, in that case, the trial judge had penned a memorandum in which basically the judge specifically stated prior to the petitioner's trial that he believed that the petitioner had in fact committed the crimes that he was on trial for while he was out on his appeal bond. Again, that type of situation simply is not presented in the instant case. Again, all the statements that Judge Sachs made were perhaps showing his impatience with the petitioner, but none of them establishes actual bias. For these reasons, we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Ms.
you.
Griffin. So, Mr. Lockhart, we had asked you to handle this case. You handle it at our request?
Yes.
Well, we thank you for your participation. And next case for